There's a McDonald's, which is named after two men. There's the Princess Bridge Hotel, Lord of the Fries, Hungry Jack's. There's also a Mr. Burger, Young and Jackson.
That's Dr. Pamela Salen. She is listing all of the businesses on one street, Elizabeth Street, in Melbourne's CBD, that have male names. This, I know, it might sound like a bizarre thing to do, right? Don't worry, we're going to expand on why she's doing this a little later in the show. But for the purpose of this episode, I want to pose a slightly weird question. Can a street be sexist? Now, before anyone out there rolls their eyes and hollers at me about how not everything is sexist, Jan, just consider that question for a second. Can a street, a mall, a walkway, a train station, a bathroom, a square, can a public place be sexist? And might they be without you even realizing it? These are the questions we're looking at on today's episode.
Sexism and the City.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to Sexism and the City, a Plan International Australia podcast. They're all about equality for girls. Yes, sirree. I'm your host, Jan Fran. Thank you so much for being here. Hi, welcome. On this episode, we are focusing on sexist public spaces. Do they exist? Where are they? What are they? What the hell am I even talking about? How on earth can a street be sexist? These are all very good questions that I am going to try and answer in this episode. But first, we're going to meet someone who up until recently didn't really think too much about whether or not a public place could be sexist.
My name's Kenneth Thor. I'm a dad living in the southeastern suburbs of Melbourne with three kids and one wife.
It's good that you had to specify it was one wife.
Yeah, so I'm just pretty normal, round-the-block sort of guy.
Kenneth might have one wife, but he has got three kids, a six-year-old boy, a four-year-old girl, and a toddler.
I never noticed sexualized imagery in advertising before I had kids, so these things have been going on since Adam was a boy, but I only noticed it when I was walking down some dimly lit corridors at Fountain Gate Shopping Centre one night.
That's a big indoor shopping centre in suburban Melbourne.
When my four-year-old daughter at that stage noticed these huge posters, 2 metres high, brightly lit, LED lit posters of very highly sexualized pictures. And she shouted, "Oh, Dad, why aren't these ladies wearing any clothes?" And I was really taken aback at that point in time. And I thought, I have no way of trying to answer this question in 2 seconds to my daughter at that time. We were just looking for some dinner, walking down the corridors looking for a restaurant. And lo and behold, my son also came running by. I wanted to change the topic really quickly and walk on by, but my son also stopped me and said, "I like it." And so at that stage, I thought, this is really quite problematic for children.
Can you describe to us what the images were?
These are best seen in reality, but if I can just describe very sexually provocative women in lingerie that look like BDSM style lingerie and posing two ladies together in very suggestive manner.
What Kenneth was actually looking at was a shop front window display for the lingerie brand Honey Burdett. Now, Honey Burdett is a particularly racy lingerie brand, right? As in, they are always making headlines for being too revealing or too raunchy or pushing boundaries. Put it this way, they're no Bonds. Okay.
And then you said you got angry.
Right. I mean, no parent should be forced to have to explain BDSM culture or pornography to their children just when they're looking for dinner at the local family shopping center. So I felt a little bit ambushed at that time, yes.
So Kenneth contacted Westfield Shopping Center.
They didn't seem to think that it was very concerning because not many people, they said, complained about those images. The lady went on to say, "I guess people are more concerned about health and junk food to children rather than a bit of boob."
Okay. one can probably imagine at this point, right, that if you are a concerned parent calling up about what you believe to be softcore pornography on public display and you get told that it's just a bit of boob, I imagine that might get your goat a little bit. So, yeah, Kenneth contacted the Advertising Standards Bureau.
2 months later, I received a response to say that the panel, or the board as they refer to them, about 25 people who sit down and they deliberate over these images, they upheld my complaint and found that the images breached section 2.4 of the AANA Code of Ethics. Don't ask me what that stands for.
Okay, section 2.4 of the code states that advertising or marketing communications shall treat sex, sexuality, and nudity with sensitivity to the relevant audience, i.e., the image was inappropriate because it exposed children to highly sexual imagery. But even after the Bureau agreed with Kenneth, he said that nothing actually changed. So he contacted Elise Monahan, the founder of Honey Birdette.
I got a response from their, what do they call them, customer experience officers, I think they call them. And the response actually said that Honey Birdette are all about desexualizing the women's body and empowering women in their own skin. So I thought, I'm dealing with either a very delusional company here, or they're just very content in what they're doing and putting up these arguments just to be able to exist out in the marketplace.
All right, let's go back to the initial question that I asked at the start of this podcast. Can a street, or in this case a mall, can a public space be sexist? Obviously, Kenneth and tens of thousands of other people think, yes. Yes, it can. Not one to back down, he launched a change.org petition to try and get Honey Birdette to take the images down. At the time of recording this podcast, that petition has clocked over 63,000 signatures and 4,000 comments, some of which include,
"They're just gross. I'm no prude, but pretty much seeing labia in sheer undies on a large poster is pretty confronting, especially with my 9-year-old son in tow.
Disgusting. Honey Birdette is not empowering women. They are degrading the next generation of girls.
I think children should be protected from seeing porn-style images whilst at a shopping centre like Westfield, which is very much the public domain. This is not feminism. It's just porn.
I was at Westfield Doncaster yesterday and almost fell over when I saw this hugely inappropriate shop front. Let's tone it down and stop using these graphic images to sell clothing. Sex sells, but this is ridiculous."
I think the interesting point about sex sells, though, is it's not gender neutral. It's always the bodies of women sell.
That was Dr. Lauren Rosewarne, who is a senior lecturer at the University of Melbourne.
And that suddenly makes this a little more complicated in terms of, we never say it that way, though. We never say that, you know, women on their back sprawled on a bed in lingerie selling, you know, any kind of product, that sells. Instead, we use sex sells as though, you know, the female body is some sort of metonym for sex as a whole. And I think that's an interesting way to think about that. But
that is a very good point that I actually have not thought about. You got me, Lauren.
You've said in the past that you believe that public sexist advertising constitutes sexual harassment. How?
If you look at the legislation in Australia as to what constitutes sexual harassment, things such as pinups, you know, scantily clad women in posters, you know, what they used to call the old cheesecake imagery, if I had that on the wall in my office and somebody came in and felt uncomfortable seeing that, that's actually named. Pinups are named in the legislation as images that create a hostile environment in a workplace. Why do we consider public space different in this regard? Public space is chock full of billboards that also have scantily clad women in them. And yet we're all forced to look at these images simply by virtue of using public space. At least with a television advertisement or a newspaper advertisement, I can turn the page, I can turn the channel. We're all held captive to billboards in a way that we can't avoid them.
This is true. We are captive. There is a major road. Let me just get this out, because I'm angry about this. There is a major road in Sydney called Parramatta Road, right? And every time I drive past this particular building, I just get really peeved by this massive billboard
that is supposed to be advertising like a shower installation service. And of course, there is this enormous image of a naked woman under the running water having a shower. And like, I'm not inherently offended by that per se, but I sit there most days in my car thinking, why? Like, why? I'm on the way to a picnic, like, right now. Why is it that I must be exposed to the naked body of a woman? You know, I did not consent to this. And now I have to look at it because I am stuck in traffic. That's what goes through my head when I'm sitting in the car on Parramatta Road. It's very fun. I don't know, am I being dramatic? Because certain councils around the world would think not. In 2016, London's mayor banned sexist advertising on the tube following this massive uproar over a poster that read, "Are you beach body ready?" And predictably, it featured a young, slim, blonde woman in a bikini next to a weight loss supplement. In 2017, Paris Council cracked down on the, quote, "dissemination, promotion and validation of degrading images." I don't know why I'm reading it in that weird voice. In 2018, Stockholm City Council voted to ban adverts which, quote, "present women or men as simply sex objects and show a stereotypical image of gender roles." Europe, eh? But all of this is obvious imagery, right? I mean, it's kind of easy to identify a half-naked person in an ad for ketchup and go, yeah, that's sexualizing women, and I don't need / want to see that on my drive to work. Thanks so much. But what about the not so obvious stuff? The advertising magazine B&T reckons that consumers can be exposed to as many as 600 messages or signals from brands per day. And that is a conservative estimate. Where are they all coming from, and how many of them must we subconsciously be absorbing going about our day?
Elizabeth Street in particular has quite a high density of mixed retail uses, fast food outlets, sex clubs, finance, and it's really quite a very crowded space.
That was Dr. Pamela Salen, a gender researcher from Monash University's XYX lab. We heard from Pamela at the very start of this episode, listing all of the businesses on Elizabeth Street in Melbourne that are named after men. Let's hear that again, shall we?
There's a McDonald's, which is named after two men. There's the Princess Bridge Hotel, Lord of the Fries, Hungry Jack's. There's also a Mr. Burger, Young and Jackson.
I reckon most people would walk through those streets and not even realize all of those businesses were named after men. I'm certainly one of those people.
Yeah, and I was too until I really actually took notice of what was actually emerging.
Now, you might be asking, why? Why is Dr. Salen doing this? What is even the point? Well, in 2016, Plan International Australia launched this sort of digital mapping tool called Free to Be. Users, mainly women and girls, were asked to drop a happy or sad pin on the map to sort of share their experiences of Melbourne. So, for example, if there was a particular part of the city that you enjoyed hanging out in, you drop a happy pin of the location on the Free to Be map. Conversely, if there was a part of the city where you felt sort of unsafe or uncomfortable, or, you know, something bad had happened there, you drop a sad pin on the map. The point is to get an idea of the spaces where women feel unsafe and basically take that information to relevant authorities, i.e. councils and city planners, to work out how to make the city safer. Look, it's a great idea, right? I'm not just saying that because it's a Plan International podcast. I promise. Elizabeth Street, and in particular that cross-section that Dr. Salen talks about, that had a pretty high concentration of sad pins, meaning it was highlighted by women and girls as a particularly dicey area. Now, a quick side note here, okay? Elizabeth Street is a busy street in Melbourne CBD. It is going to attract a lot of pins because it attracts a lot of people. So bear that in mind. Nonetheless, Dr. Salen wanted to work out exactly what was going on there.
So what I did is then I went out and did a photographic analysis of actually what was happening on the streetscape. So I didn't have any preconceived ideas of what I was looking for. I just wanted to capture, okay, what's the kind of language, the messaging, the advertising that is apparent and visible from the street level?
What she found, I have to say, kind of, it's sort of like did blow my mind in this weird way.
And so what I found was that there was a high prevalence of male branded businesses or other male kind of connotations, in addition to sexualized images of women.
Okay, that wasn't the mind-blowing bit. The mind-blowing bit comes next. I guess I'm trying to understand how that impacts experience in public space.
I think that it could be a factor that would create maybe a power imbalance if we're surrounded by a high density of language that is privileging men over females, then there could be some relationship with the experience of women not feeling as included or being a part of that space on a very subtle, nuanced level, something that we are not conscious of.
Wow. So the idea that Lord of the Fries could be having some kind of sort of subconscious impact on people frequenting an area, particularly women.
That could be the case, because in that case, you know, it really could be privileging more of a kind of a masculine sort of stereotype.
Now, I want to make one thing very, very clear here, right? I'm not saying for a second that the businesses themselves are sexist, but the idea that the name of a business could potentially impact a person's experience of a street or a space without that person even realizing it, that sounds kind of a bit out there to me. But Dr. Salen says that she's going off the information told to her by the women and girls who used the Free to Be map.
They did identify some of the fast food outlets that had masculine names as being an attraction for dodgy people. They even recommended removing that, and that would remove the problem.
Really?
Yeah, that was actually identified.
So not calling Hungry Jack's would remove the problem of the venue of Hungry Jack's potentially attracting dodgy people?
That's what one comment said, yes.
Okay, I do have to raise a skeptical eyebrow about that.
Of course.
But yeah, that's interesting.
It is interesting. What's interesting is that this individual just identified that this particular venue was problematic, but at the same time, you know, it's also named after a male. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's the causal impact, but it could play a factor on a very subconscious level that would attract a certain type of aggressive behavior in that certain location.
Kind of crazy, right? Try it. Try it where you live. Walk down a main street. Just make a note of the names of the businesses that you see and how many there are that are named after men or have masculine names. And look, to be fair, it might just be something that's particular to Elizabeth Street in Melbourne. I don't know. I've never actually done it. Or it might not. There is a flip side to this as well, though. So Dr. Salen conducted the same sort of analysis on another well-known area of Melbourne CBD, DeGrave Street. Now, this street attracted a lot of happy pins on the Free to Be map. So it was an area that women and girls enjoyed.
The first thing that stood out is that there was a lot of very unique and individual branding. There was noticeably less gendered messaging. It was much more neutral names. So there was noticeably much more unique and individually named brands. There was a more positive and welcoming messaging. Some of the businesses were named like Chow or Belgian Waffle, Homemade Pasta, Clementines. So they had a very different sort of kind of vibe about them.
I mean, I just find this so interesting that a street can have a particular vibe. And that vibe can be a masculine vibe or a feminine vibe, and that could potentially impact then the experiences of men and women in that street.
I agree. I think that this is something that really does require some further attention to investigate how that this really is playing out. I mean, could these really be factors that are affecting our behaviors in ways that we're really actually not even noticing.
Gosh, what would we change Hungry Jack's name to? Hungry Jill's.
Yeah, exactly.
That'll fix it.
That's right.
Now, I'm just going to make this clear. You heard Dr. Salen. A lot more research needs to be done here to understand how gendered messages, signals, and signs impact the experience of women and girls in public spaces, if at all. And certainly there would be other factors at play, like lighting, like whether it was easy to get around or not, like whether there were people that would frequent the area. Look, I don't want anybody writing a stern letter to Hungry Jack's about them changing their names just yet. Still, I am particularly curious why these two streets, Elizabeth and De Grave Street, were experienced so differently by women and girls. Luckily, I have a producer, Kayla, who, along with our audio engineer, Gavin, actually left the studio, yay, to chat to, I'm guessing, every single lady they ran into on those respective streets, just to work out what kind of experiences they had.
There's like a hostility in the air. Everyone's very individualistic and focused on their own trajectory.
The other day, there was a match, a football match, and it finished around 10 o'clock, 11 p.m. And when I was going home, because I'm using this way always, Elizabeth Street, and obviously I've seen some drunk people who approach me. Obviously, I didn't feel safe because they were under drugs and alcohol.
Do you find when you're not feeling safe, it's more the type of people around rather than the physical landscape of the city that influences that?
Yeah, definitely people, not the streets, I would say.
Men take up more space than women and can be quite dominating on the street. There's definitely a sense of entitlement in public.
I feel safe and welcome, but at night it changes. At night you get a lot of like homeless and drug people, and this is the only area we can smoke. I would come out by myself, but I would prefer to come out with people, because sometimes it can be a bit, you get people approaching you, and sometimes it can be a bit uncomfortable. It's a very busy street. You have the station, Flinders Street station, just there. That, as you can see now, there's people commuting back home, and it's good because you get a good mix of people, and it's a good chance to meet people. I don't know why, but at night I feel it's different. Like, obviously, it's a social area. There's a lot of businesses around here that are open, but at night they're closed, and I just feel a bit more unsafe.
I think it's a fair point to say that you don't feel safe when drunk dudes, or drunk anyone, really, are hanging around, right? Like, it can be a flammable situation. But it sounds like there is a sort of vibe that some girls feel here too. So again, back to the original question. Can a street be sexist?
Yes. I think that in general, public space is largely masculine.
That was Dr. Lauren Rosewarne again.
Now, I think that it can be less so through laws, through things like lighting, but in general, we tend to have this association of public space as being the domain of men and the private sphere being that of women, and therefore space has been organised accordingly and not with great consideration of the needs of women.
Let me give you an example of that by asking the ladies, particularly listening to this podcast, this is going to be an awkward question. Have you ever peed in public? As in, after a night out, it's late, the bars are closed, you're on your way home, you need to pee. We've all been there, okay? We've all popped a squat near a shrub somewhere. No shame. So a few years back, a 23-year-old Dutch woman was fined $145 for whizzing in an alleyway after a night out in Amsterdam. It was your classic scenario, right? It was past closing time. The nearest public toilet was a couple of Ks away. So she kind of finds this quiet street while her mates keep watch, pops a squat, and boom, busted by three cops. My God, just imagine that scenario for a second. Anyway, she basically called BS on the fine. And her argument was that Amsterdam had not been designed to accommodate the needs of women, i.e. there were 35 public urinals for men around the city at the time, compared with just three public toilets designed for women. And let's be real, who is going to walk to those toilets at the best of times, let alone in heels at night while drunk? Like, no.
Anyway, the case went to court, and the judge apparently told her that she should have used one of the men's urinals, which I'm not entirely sure that judge understood how vulvas work. Yeah, rightly so, though. The whole thing caused a bit of a stir in Amsterdam, and it's just one example of a public space that privileges the experience of those with a peen, so to speak.
So going back to the streets.
The streets.
I just heard how that. Let's go back to the streets, Lauren, me and you.
All right.
That's what I've always wanted.
But going back to talking about whether a street can or can't be sexist and this idea of masculine spaces, how do we start to rectify spaces that are perhaps overly or exclusively masculine?
I think you need to step back and ask users of space, what makes you feel included and what makes you feel excluded? And I think we need to get to the bottom of what makes women scared of public space, because there is, and we know the data supports this, there is a lot of fear amongst women, particularly young women, about their safety in public space.
Well, we know that women and girls in Melbourne, at least, are a little bit sus on Elizabeth Street. I think the next step is to work out why and then to work out how to change it. And I must say, I hadn't thought too much about the role of urban planners in combating sexism, but of course they play a role. And there's a part of me that would just love to be a fly on the wall in those meetings about city design. Like, who is leading those meetings? You know, what's taken into consideration when designing a public space in terms of how people use it? Whose perspectives are taken into consideration and how? I don't know. These are questions for another time, I think. And while, look, I don't like to say I told you so, although to be fair, I do quite like to say I told you so, am I right in thinking that you might not look at your city the same way again? I don't know. That is all from me for now, though. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Hope to chat to you soon. Sexism in the City is a Plan International Australia podcast. It's hosted by me, Jan Fran. The series is produced by Kayla Robertson. Associate producer is Gavin Naber. It's mixed by Gavin Naber at the Hallwood Recording Studio at the University of Melbourne. Researched by Andrea Kano-Botero and Madeline Spencer. Artwork is by Donna Kelly. Theme music is by Paul Greenstein. If you have any thoughts on the episode or you want to find out more about Plan's work, head to Plan International Australia's website at plan.org.au/podcast or find me on Facebook, Jan Fran. Find me on the internet. I'm there. Hope to hear from you. Bye.